My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagerits, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we actually have some sort of bubble clash happening because we're talking about the AI bubble versus the Western bubble. Balder, why are we talking about this topic today?
Hi, Dario. Well, a number of reasons. First of all, for many months, people have been worrying or discussing a potential AI bubble, basically a fear that financial markets are sometime going to collapse, similarly to what happened in 2008. That has been on the radar for a long time. Today, as we're recording, it's Friday the 21st of November, and markets are significantly down by about 4%. And people are today claiming that this might be the start of the crash. Now, when we publish this recording, it will be Monday, and by then maybe markets are shooting up again, who knows. But there is certainly a lot of reason to be concerned about inflated stock markets that could then affect the rest of the economy. However, there's something bigger here, which is namely that relationship between those financial bubbles that we possibly are witnessing versus the Western bubble that has been developing for the past 25, 30 years, arguably for hundreds of years, but certainly visibly for the past 30 years. And they are not exactly in sync with each other, right? In many ways, the current financial world is kind of undermining the processes that led to the Western bubble. Whether that's good or bad is a different story, but it's certainly interesting to analyze.
Excellent. But before we actually get started with today's topic, you went on a trip to Valencia in Spain this week to do, right? So sometimes we do that. Did we kind of do live recordings or we just go and, talk about the Western bubble because people invite us. And you actually went to Valencia to do that on Tuesday, right? I mean, apart from the fact that a trip to Valencia is always worth taking, there were some observations you wanted to chat about before.
Indeed, and it's always a pleasure. And to any Americans listening, high-speed rail links are amazing. You know, Madrid-Valencia, it's only 2 hours. It's just incredible. And Valencia is always lovely. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I was invited by Universitat Europea, which is has a beautiful campus there in Valencia. And it's really nice to have these events again, because for a while I stopped doing them because of work. It wasn't really relevant. But now with the podcast, we have a renewed reason to talk about these things, right? So that is lovely. And it was a very interesting event with students and professors from the university. And it was also very interesting to see different reactions, right? A lot of interesting conversations that before and after, as well as during the event itself. And one of the things that really struck me was this conversation about, hey, Balder, it's very nice that you talk about, you know, the problem with how the West views itself, but surely the West does represent some kind of objective moral truth. And that is so deeply ingrained in the Western bubble, right? So in many ways, that is exactly the Western bubble that we've been discussing over all of these episodes as we've been recording. There is this latent idea in the West among academics, among professionals, among politicians, that yes, we can of course all agree that some things are not right about Western behavior. Of course, we can all agree that, you know, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a horrible project that should never have occurred. We can all agree that there's a certain arrogance, that there's neocolonialism, all of those things. But a lot of people still believe that at the core, the West has this objective truth that it's defending. And it's very difficult to get that out of the system. People cannot wrap their head around the idea that liberal democracy, Christian values, to some extent, are not the foundation of objectivity.
Did they mention, right, so you just said it, right, Christian morality, but did they go into detail what these objective truths were? Because I have a tough time wrapping my head around what would constitute an objective truth in today's world, except that climate change is real.
Well, indeed, and well, the Belgium is a little bit silly as a country. That's another objective truth. But yes, exactly. The issue here is that there is no mechanism to determine objectivity. Right? You can go down the whole solipsistic road with philosophy that we can't be sure about anything because we could be brains in a vat, we could live in a matrix. We have no way of getting out of that philosophical problem. But at a more practical level, there is no objectivity beyond maybe vaguely observing that humanity throughout its history, throughout various civilizations, has had some sense of fairness, for example. That is an objective kind of thing that you observe through. But then when you start talking about how does that kind of fairness manifest itself, now it becomes a very subjective exercise. What is fairness? How do you define it? How do you achieve it? That really depends on the time period, on the civilization. And so what you then often get, and what also in Valencia was part of the conversation, was, yeah, well, but liberal democracy and also latent or fundamental Christian values put the individual first. Well, first of all, I've got some doubts about that, whether the individual actually is that well protected by the West, right? I mean, certainly a lot of individuals are left by the roadside, but even if that was the case, then that is in itself not a universal truth, because lots of other traditions, cultures, histories have focused on communal well-being or state well-being or societal well-being. So to say, hey, I care about the individual being at the core, human rights, etc., etc., is a very specific subjective position to take. One, by the way, that I feel very comfortable with and that I would certainly defend in my own society, but I will never be able to claim that that is some kind of objective, obvious truth, because it isn't. There is no mechanism to determine that truth.
So you said, right, that there were some kind of criticisms of the Western bubble. What was the overall reaction? I mean, I think you mentioned there were roughly 100 people, right, in the auditorium listening.
Yeah, it was very positive. It was a really fun, interesting event organized by a good friend of mine, and overall, I think people enjoyed it, and there were some critical questions. There were some people who very much seemed to be already aligned with what I said. I also had a chance to rant a little bit about NATO, because I initially had been invited to a NATO event that I couldn't attend. And that, you know, you can imagine what NATO events are like. Everyone just fully embracing the 5% expenditure of GDP on defense and those kinds of things. And so I now had a chance to basically complain a little bit about that approach. And of course, what you see is that certainly the younger generation also has its doubts about this, right? There's typically younger students don't really understand why we're doing this, and neither do I. So there was a good connection there. And then, yeah, now overall, it was very, very interesting. But I just, my main takeaway from this, besides having an interesting experience, was that people find it very difficult to step out of objectivity. And I would like to say one more thing about objectivity that people don't really seem to realize. You and I can have an objective conversations once we establish a foundational objective, right? So if you and I say we want to increase well-being of an individual, if you and I agree on that and we define what well-being is, and we agree what we mean by well-being, now we can have an objective analysis about how do we get there. There might still be mistakes we make, but it's an objective process. Like, okay, we want to achieve this. We agree that we want to achieve this. Now, that is an objective thing. But that only depends. That can only happen because if we agree on our objective and we agree on the definitions that lead to that objective. And then objectivity kicks in, but not before that. Right.
The listeners can't see this right now, but I'm smiling. That's not because I think what you're saying is funny, but it reminds me of the time that I did debate in high school in the United States. Right, one of the very important things, of course, at the beginning is to define the terms you will be using. And I think it was something along, like the topic was something along the lines that globalization overall, improves poverty. And I remember I defined poverty as the lack of something, and the opposition didn't provide another definition. And I said, well, people lack a Mercedes-Benz. Most people don't have a Mercedes-Benz, so therefore they're poor. And then the opposing side said, yeah, but that means that the majority of the world is poor, and that And I was like, yeah, and globalization would give everyone a Mercedes if you would let them buy them. Right, it was a ridiculous argument that I just had a lot of fun. And in the end, I was fortunate enough that the judge thought it was hilarious and that the opposing counsel didn't provide a definition of their own. And yeah, so you can talk about poverty in the sense of, oh, I don't have enough to eat, or I don't have a Mercedes Benz.
Well, that's exactly it. And according to human rights, I mean, we have a right, according to the United Nations, we have a right to a dignified life. Now, if I say I only feel dignified if I live in a castle, then is the UN going to give me a castle, right? So it has a statement like that is used all the time, but it has no value until you define things, until you're clear about what you mean. And once you have the definition and you agree on the definition, now you can go into an objective analysis of, okay, how do we achieve this? How do we accomplish what we want to accomplish? But that is a subset of objectivity at a broader level. And the idea that there's something objectively superior or objectively better, just universally from every human's perspective, about Western liberal democracy versus any other system is just untenable. You can't get there. You can't reach that conclusion philosophically.
The other day I had a discussion with a group of young people, and I casually mentioned the Nord Stream sabotage, right? Something that we've also done an episode about, and very few of them knew about it, which shocked me a little bit because it's not ancient history. Boulder, I want you to feel the same. And I want you to tell us, the listeners, about ancient history. Tell us about the dot-com bubble. How did you experience that, right? Because, I mean, I was born, but I wasn't aware. But you were born already, and you were certainly aware. What was the dot-com bubble like?
Well, I personally wasn't really much affected by it at all. It didn't, you know, my job wasn't affected by it. My life wasn't affected by it. I also didn't have particularly high investments in the financial world. But what was very interesting to see is that at the foundation, just like now what you see with AI, there was something real, right? The internet had been developing over time. And the result of the internet developing was that then people became overly optimistic, and you see this disconnect between economic realities and just people being hyper positive and the financial world going way above that economic reality. And so then at some point, that is what a bubble is, right? Not so much economic growth and prosperity and people believing in the future, but people believing so much in the future that investors no longer look at PE ratios, no longer look at the foundations of economics. And I think there's a really interesting similarity there with respect to AI and where the world that we live in today in 2025. Because what you see is that, of course, there's something real. AI is real. It's going to have an impact on our economy. We don't know to what extent. The internet was very much real in the 1990s. It led to the world that we live in today. But it being real and changing the world doesn't mean that we can just go crazy and just start inventing things. And that's exactly what the financial world did at the end of this bubble, of the dot-com bubble. And that is likely something that is happening right now in 2025 as well.
Because it is absolutely insane to observe these valuations and the stock market connected to AI companies. I mean, the biggest one that we're talking about, right, is the chip maker Nvidia. In German, it's much easier to pronounce that. Because what astonishes me is that their valuation is larger than the entire German annual economic output, right? So we're talking about $5 trillion US dollars in valuation. In Germany's economic output is only 4.66 trillion US dollars, at least in 2025. That is enormous, and the company is larger than the entire basically German publicly traded company stock market.
Yeah, and so if you look at PE value, so I'm saying something obvious to a lot of our listeners, but maybe not to others. So the value of a company is essentially the assets that a company has. Now, in the case of Nvidia, there's a lot of intellectual property and all that, and there's some infrastructure, but it's mostly the other thing, namely not just the value that the company has in terms of assets, but also in future earnings, right? Like, what is the company going to earn next year, the year after, and all that. And so you have a PE ratio, price earnings ratio, where you look at Okay, if I now buy this company, how long will it take me to get my money back in profits? And a historically reasonable number PE ratio for a normal company that is, just growing steadily without anything special is maybe anywhere between 8 and 12 or something like that. Like it takes you buy a share and then it takes you that much time to get it back. But in terms of AI or in the past, in the 1990s dot-com companies, what you have is the idea that the current earnings are not nothing compared to future earnings, right? So that the idea is that Nvidia, yes, they're earning money today, but it's much more likely that 10 years down the line that it's 200 or 300 times as much. Now, the problem with the current evaluation, which I think is about a PE ratio of 50, is that a lot of that ratio is even underestimating the reality that Nvidia actually earns a lot of money through its own activities by basically having its whole infrastructure and therefore is cooking the books a little bit. If Nvidia were to actually fulfill its promise of 5 trillion evaluation in the stock market, they would have to sell an enormous amount of chips that basically would have to be generating economic value elsewhere. And it's not at all clear where that economic value would come from. Right now, people, individual consumers, are not actually spending that much on AI, right? Individual consumers are not willing to pay huge premiums for ChatGPT Pro or whatever it's called. I don't use it. There is actually very little money going from the standard economy into the AI sector. So at some point, either these companies are going to have to find a model that monetizes from the real economy their valuations, or it's going to collapse. And I think that a lot of people are saying, well, right now these valuations can just not be reached in a reasonable world because people are just not going to spend this amount of money.
There was an MIT study in August of 2025 that stated that despite for like 30, 40 billion US dollar investments right into generative AI, 95% of those organizations kind of reported zero returns out of that, right? So there's a lot of money being put into this because, of course, a lot of companies are expecting and hoping that they will get something out of this, right? Of course, this could be more efficiency. This could be right. Just I mean, maybe cutting labor, right? Throwing out employees onto the street who then can't purchase something in return, right in that. But as of now, they're not seeing that. And that kind of puts further pressure on this entire system. And what you mentioned about the right, this kind of circular investment. I mean, that's something that that does seem a little bit concerning to me, and as someone who has not studied economics or anything, but it does seem fishy that right that Nvidia is investing 100 billion into OpenAI, and then OpenAI is buying right is using that money to basically buy chips from Nvidia, and then you have Oracle, and then you have CoreWeave, and all these different companies basically moving money around, and it's not only us who are saying that and who are seeing that risk, but it's also the CEO of Google, right? Who's kind of Sundar Pichai, who said that right, the growth of artificial investment is of course something extraordinary for them. Of course, they're making money, but he did say that there was, and I quote, some irrationality in the current AI boom. I mean, and that's the guy who's I mean, that's the CEO of Google, right? Of Alphabet, I should be.
Yeah, so it's, and you mentioned OpenAI. OpenAI haven't act hasn't actually shown that their business model is profitable at all, right? So Nvidia makes a profit, but OpenAI doesn't make a profit at the moment. It is a loss-making machine. Now, none of this means that AI is a hoax. Of course, AI is changing our world. Of course, it has an enormous impact on our world. And I mean, there are some sectors where you can very easily understand where AI will change things. People will lose their jobs. For example, I wouldn't put my money on translators. Language, just it's so much easier these days to just translate something through AI than it is by phoning someone who speaks the language, right? There are some areas where it's completely obvious that AI is going to have an impact and might be a way to basically cut costs by firing people. Now, these large companies, they have to be a little bit careful because at some point, who is going to buy their products? If everyone gets fired, you know, you've got a problem, right? You need consumers. But the reality is that beyond specific sectors, it's not at all clear how much money can actually be made through this. And so the idea of an investor saying, I believe in NVIDIA, I believe in these AI companies, just like I believe in dot-com companies, I think that a company like Google or Amazon is going to make profit in the future. Fine, absolutely, of course. But we don't know how much. And right now, we believe that the sky is the limit and the revenue stream isn't there to back up the current expectations. And that's why we believe that there's a bubble. And we'll go back to reasonable numbers, just like in the early 2000s, you see the financial markets starting to look at reasonable projections of what a company like Google or Amazon or whatever could actually make and basing itself off that.
I should point out that we've already had a discussion about AI, right? Just for the listeners who may have missed that episode where we talked about our concerns with AI, about just our personal development, psychology of children, and so on, right? Because I mean, as you said, with the dot-com bubble, right? I mean, that didn't stop the internet.
No.
And I don't think any AI bubble bursting is going to stop AI.
No, of course not.
That would be
AI is there, and the internet is there, and it's got nothing to do with no one should walk away from this saying, oh, bother thinks that AI is some kind of fake hoax. It clearly isn't. It is huge, but it's not as big as financial markets seem to make it at the moment, and that's the very definition of a bubble.
And then let's add to that, right, the kind of the Western bubble component. And one thing that's very concerning to me is that all of the, I mean, we're looking at a very few set of individuals who are in charge of these highly valued companies, right? So Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, NVIDIA, OpenAI, usually men, right? Usually men from the United States who do like to be very close to the US president and who likes to be very close to them. Because, I mean, we also know that a significant amount of kind of economic growth and economic development in the United States in the past year has been due to AI investments, that the rest of the economy isn't doing so well. So you kind of also have this set of managers, and this is an element that Western bubble listeners are very familiar with. You have the set of managers who are just interested in kind of getting that next AI stage and kind of growing the economy with that and generating a lot of power and winning the fight against the evil Chinese, right? Who are all, of course, also trying to do AI. That on top of everything that we've just said is to me even more concerning, right? That you have this all in the hands of a very few individuals.
Yeah, and this is something. So if you look at the numbers, a lot of the wealth accumulation over the past 10 years has been what you said, like AI financial assets and real estate again. And those are not real economic foundations, right? So the fact that your house on paper is all of a sudden worth twice as much as it was 10 years ago in itself has no meaning. It has no economic meaning. It's just a number that will only have meaning to you if you sell your house and you go and live under a tree. Because if you don't live under a tree, you have to buy a new house or you have to rent, and the prices are just as high up. And so there is currently, because of the rising asset prices, there is an enormous amount of cash liquidity in the market. There is so much money available. Berkshire Hathaway, one of the few billionaires that I actually kind of have a soft spot for, Warren Buffett. They've got about $300 billion in cash that are waiting to invest. Just money waiting to be spent, right? There is way too much money in the economy right now. And that means that the financial markets seem to be able to cover the bubble very, very well. Because that small group of people, so those managers you mentioned, and then maybe the 10% of wealthiest people who have all these assets in our society, they are keeping all of this artificially high. But the fundamentals of the economy are actually doing quite badly. The managers don't have a vision about that. They don't seem to understand really what they're doing. They think that life can be great forever, and for them it probably will be because they've got all these assets. And even if the assets collapse by 90%, they're still billionaires. You know, they have nothing to worry about. But the underlying fundamental economics is just not there to sustain this kind of pattern, right? And then if you look at what we just said about, for example, translators losing their job because AI is going to replace them, all kinds of graphic designers losing their job because AI coders losing their job, all of that, then that only worsens the situation because it is already pretty bad. For everyone who is not in the top 10%, the world is doing quite badly. Their life is not, they're not as well off as they were 25 years ago. And so at some point, this is bound to collapse. And the only reason why it hasn't yet is probably because of that enormous liquidity in the market.
I mean, another aspect of this that I've been thinking about quite a lot, because right, that topic of youth unemployment, I mean, particularly young graduates trying to go into the job market and not finding any jobs because there are simply no longer any entry-level positions. And companies are only looking for that senior who can train the AI and who can tell the AI all the smart things. I mean, and kind of replacing all these juniors, in that sense, companies are running into a big problem because you will not have any of those smart seniors in 10 years, right? Because if you're not training anyone there at the bottom. So, I mean, yeah, we're creating a lot of problems for ourselves at the moment, where it seems like these managers aren't aware. And I think the best example is Mustafa Suleiman. He's the CEO of AI at Microsoft. And he tweeted on X, and I quote, "Geez, there are so many cynics. It cracks me up when I hear people call AI underwhelming. I grew up playing Snake on a Nokia phone." Me too. That was not part of the quote. I continue with the quote. "The fact that people are unimpressed that we can have a fluent conversation with a super smart AI that can generate any image video is mind-blowing to me." End quote. This guy doesn't get it at all.
No, and it kind of reminds me of Jeff Bezos a month ago or so saying that he doesn't understand why people are so gloomy because soon space will provide us all the resources we need, right? These people live in their own tiny little bubble. It's not necessarily a Western bubble. It's just a bubble that they live in where they don't understand the actual problem. So, of course, I think anyone with half a brain is impressed with that humans can build something like AI. It's incredible that you can have a conversation with AI and it seems like a real human being. Like, you know, it's amazing that they can just translate all hundreds of languages for you in a few seconds, something that before you would have to send off to a translator. All of that is absolutely incredible. And everyone understands that that's incredible. The problem is that people aren't impressed with AI because it's threatening an already fragile existence for them. It's threatening their jobs. It's not something that they can reach. They don't have the money to invest in AI, unlike the people who give those quotes, right? Bezos saying, oh yeah, why aren't people so excited about the future? Because we have the whole of space to harvest for its resources, that is a sign of someone who doesn't understand that your average person will not have agency over that process, will not own that process, will not be part of the wealth that's being accumulated there. And if these people would sit and think for 1 second, they would propose some kind of model where AI or space or all those things that they themselves are so super hyper excited about will somehow be fairly distributed to the masses so that they can continue having the economic fundamentals and actually continue turning a profit. Because at some point, they're going to be the only ones left and they will live in some kind of dystopian society where no one else is profiting. If we want to use AI for a proper future where everyone can actually look at it and says, hey, this has worked for me, we need to find a way to redistribute some of the profits that are being made out of this financial bubble that we live in.
So that sounds to me like that these managers are messing up their own future, right? Because they're basically digging their own grave.
Yeah, so one of the problems that you saw in the 1990s that they thought, and we've discussed this many times over in the podcast, that people thought, hey, the only thing we need to care about is economics and we don't have to worry about vision, we don't have to worry about ideology, the only thing that matters is keep interest rates low, keep unemployment low, and everything will be fine because this is the liberal magic formula. And that required, that was always a mistaken understanding, but it required competent management. So you see people such as Clinton and Blair and others focusing on how can we competently manage the economy, make the central bank independent, etc., etc. Now, that was already always a very problematic project because you do need vision, you do need to look at huge income inequality that rises out of that, etc., etc. And that is not me being a Marxist, that is just me rationally looking at how economics functions. But what is happening now, because of those elite managers you mentioned, those managers that have way too much wealth and way too little understanding of the realities that people are facing, is that they're not even competent managers anymore. They're creating incompetence in the system. The Trump administration is flirting with the idea of no longer publishing certain statistics about the US economy because they know it looks bad. They don't want to publish statistics on unemployment, for example, because they know it's going up and it's a very dire picture. They want to politically influence statistics agencies. They no longer want any independence from reporting agencies. And that means that management of the economy, which was already never enough, is now also incompetent. It is based on flawed information, which will only lead to an even worse collapse than otherwise you would see, right? So the Western bubble initially was just very simplified, simplistic thinking about what society needed. And now we're not even providing that simplistic approach anymore. Now we're doing a bad job even at just that.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the AI bubble versus the Western bubble. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
As I mentioned 10 minutes ago, one of the few billionaires that at least I have some sympathy for, at least seems to be much more competent in understanding reality than others, is Warren Buffett. He certainly didn't become rich because of the dot-com bubble or because of the AI bubble. He was already rich well before because he was just a very good investor. And he is one of the people who also understands the moral consequences and the long-term consequences of the world that he lives in. And for example, his billionaire status, right? And there are lots of quotes to choose from, but I chose this one. It goes, "A pin lies in wait for every bubble, and when the two eventually meet, a new wave of investors learns some very old lessons."